supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, a lot of you are probably thinking about doing some pruning. Now that the weather seems perfect for that kind of work, we want to warn you against that. And we want to tell you the rules that you can follow to reduce screening plants down in size while still keeping them nice looking. It's something we get a lot of questions about, and we'll have definitive answers. After a lot of your fascinating phone calls, at 1-888-346-9499. Tim, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. How are you?
I am just fine, Tim. How are you, sir?
I'm doing okay. I'm doing okay.
And where is Tim doing okay?
I'm in Frederick, Maryland.
Oh, I know it well. What can we do for Tim in Frederick?
Okay, over the course of the past several months, my landscape has changed very significantly. In March, my neighbor took down two large conifers that were about 15 to 18 inches in diameter. That were right on the property line. They provided the shade to my shade garden for the most part. And then 3 weeks ago, a wind came through our neighborhood and took down four oak trees of 3 feet in diameter, three of them across the road, and mine ended up on my house. My basic question is, my yard, I'm in a neighborhood that used to be the most shaded treed neighborhood in the city, and now my yard is almost full sun for like from 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock in the morning on.
And your hostas are really unhappy.
Yeah, exactly. So I've got a shade garden that had hostas and ferns, and typically I would wait till the fall to move them. However, I'm afraid that they're going to spend the rest of summer just baking in the sun, so I wanted to know whether you thought it was best to move them now or whether I should go ahead and let them tough it out and move them in the fall.
I'm going to suggest to you that the hostas have been crying out for help, but that the ferns probably look okay, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, the hostas, they're doing okay. They look a little bleached, but for the most part, they don't look too bad.
And let's be honest, you're in the D.C. area, and like our Philadelphia area, like most of the whole mid-Atlantic states, this has been a very cool summer. We're on, I think we might be on some kind of a record, not necessarily for rain, although we've had more rain than we need. But the cool
right.
weather has been ridiculous at times. So in one sense, and as I should have said in the beginning, condolences for your lost trees. That's a real tragedy, especially the oaks. But if it had to happen, this is the gentlest summer.
Exactly.
So I think that your instincts not to overreact are probably good, that this summer has not been really stressful. It hasn't been hot to begin with. I don't think it's going to get especially hot from now through the end. And there's been adequate moisture, all of which can help protect shade-loving plants that get exposed to more sun than they'd like. So you are welcome to wait until fall. I don't think any harm will be done. I might, especially with the hostas, I might just leave them alone until spring. When the hostas start to emerge and green up again in the spring, that's the time that they can take transplanting, and you know, you may want to divide them. My hostas are so big I have to use a chainsaw. I cut them into quarters and they thrive. But there'd be no...
Yeah, I have a few that are getting like that as well.
Yeah. And new plants that are purchased always do best when planted in the fall. But when you're breaking up and moving plants and dividing them, I think the early spring, as soon as the soil is unfrozen and they show you where they are, that's when they're at their most dramatically strong, because that's when all their energy goes into growth and the things you do can harm them the least. So, I mean, if you have personal constrictions that make the spring a bad time, you can do it this fall. But otherwise, the basic answer is no, I would not panic and move them now. I don't think there's any need to.
Okay, great.
And now you got a place to grow tomatoes.
Yeah, that is the truth. We had lost any chance of growing tomatoes up until recently, but I actually think I'm going to replace the oak with another tree once they get the stump out of there, but we'll see when that happens.
He's a shade-loving man, ladies and gentlemen.
Exactly.
All right, Tim. Good luck, sir.
Well, thank you very much, Mike.
My pleasure. 1-888-346-9499. Diana, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you, Mike.
Well, thank you, Diana. How are you?
I'm doing well.
And where is Diana doing well?
I am from South Jersey, currently in Manhattan, though.
Well, currently, like, for the day or living in Manhattan?
Currently for the day.
Oh, okay. Well, I love New York, actually. It's a fun place to go to. So you live in South Jersey, and that's where your question is?
That is correct. That's where my little garden sits.
Oh, okay. So what's going wrong for Diana in the Garden State?
So I have a raised bed that has a trellis, and in it I usually grow my acorn squash, spaghetti squash, butternut squash, my winter squashes, so to speak. And for the past 2 years, I've been overrun by stink bugs. They don't harm the vegetable, but they kill the plant, which then kills the vegetable.
Well, you'll find that actually a lot of times they will go to the fruit. They will pierce the fruit with their suckers. They're just enormously difficult. They are a very difficult pest to keep away. Now, you have a special problem in that the plants you are growing are constantly flowering. And did you say you have summer squash in there? I lost track of all your squashes.
Acorn, spaghetti, butternut. I even have cucumbers and lima beans in there as well.
So you have flowers constantly opening and closing.
Correct.
See, that makes it difficult. If this were a situation, for instance, like my peach trees, where they're, you know, the flowers appear once, and after that you have a tree full of fruit to protect, then you can spray with spinosads, which are an organically approved insecticide that's very effective against stink bugs, but it is toxic to bees for the first 3 hours after application. So if you were willing to go out at some point, just as the stink bugs are showing up, and deflower all of your plants, knowing that all of the flowers on the squash and the beans that you've talked about, these flowers will simply reappear. They'll just regrow new flowers. But if you were to remove every flower so that there would be no attraction to bees temporarily, you could spray the heck out of these plants with one of the spinosads, which is a relatively new, very effective, again, organic insecticide. And that would work two ways. First, it's a feeding deterrent. When the stink bugs show up, they're deterred. And the second way it works is if they're not deterred and they start causing problems, then they die. Other option would be neem, N-E-E-M, and this is an ancient organic insecticide that is made from the seeds of a tree that grows naturally in India, and neem is perhaps the best anti-feedant, meaning that makes the plants unattractive to pests, but again, if they insist and try to eat the plant, they will die. And I think neem is safer to use around bees, although I don't see any loss in pulling the flowers off before you would use any of these. The only thing is it's hard to find the insecticidal form of neem. It's very specialized, so you need to be able to get it mail order or have a really hip independent garden center. Whereby the spinosads, and it'll say spinosad as the active ingredient on a package, you'll see that on a lot of natural insecticides around. Otherwise, these stink bugs, the best hope we have is beneficial insects are being bred and released right now that go after these stink bugs. It's specifically one of these little parasitic wasps that's so small we can't see them. But this specialized wasp was imported from the same Asian country the stink bugs recently came over from. and it inserts its eggs into the stink bug's eggs, so the stink bug eggs don't hatch into stink bugs, and instead come out more of these little helpful little wasps. So these wasps we're hoping they're going to get the stink bug population under control in the next couple of years. There are stink bug traps. They have to be hung pretty far away from your plants. You don't want to bring the stink bugs right to your plants. But honestly, your best answer is going to be neem or spinosad, being careful not to impact the bees, which, of course, you have a lot of if you're getting a lot of squash.
Okay. I guess it's kind of a good thing that the stink bugs have only started showing up about a week ago. So this way, if I pinch back those flowers and use those spinosads, I'm not going to harm the bees, and I'll take care of the stink bugs.
I think you got a plan.
That sounds good to me. Thank you so much, Mike.
All right. Thank you, Diana.
You have a great day.
You too. Bye-bye. Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that I'll be doing a free composting workshop on Wednesday evening, September 10th, at the Phoenixville Country Club. Don't worry, I'll dress up like a waiter so they'll let me in. I'll reveal everything you need to know to turn your soon-to-be abundant fall leaves and maybe even some of your kitchen waste into fabulous food and mulch for your lawn, landscape, and garden plants. That's Wednesday, September 10th at 7:30 at the Phoenixville Country Club in, of course, Phoenixville, PA. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back at you with more of your fabulous phone calls and the rules for pruning screening evergreens so that you don't lose that wonderful screen. I'm well-screened Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
You Bet Your Garden is made possible in part by Summit Responsible Solutions. Summit mosquito dunks and mosquito bits contain BTI, which naturally controls mosquitoes without harming other living things, including people and pets. Online at summitresponsiblesolutions.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, a row of evergreens provides great screening from a road, but they're getting too high, getting close to power lines. Should they be cut back? When and by how much, and how can we not kill them? We'll answer all those burning questions in the question of the week, which is burning, as are your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Fran, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, Mike, how you doing?
I'm doing good, Fran. How you doing?
I'm doing pretty good myself. I'm calling from the Philadelphia area, right outside of Philly in the Ben Salem, actually. Not far from the Chamonix State Park.
Okay, very good. What can we do for Fran out by the park?
The problem I had was weeds and grass just growing through a brick patio that I had put in a few years ago. just to give you some, what the patio was made of was a concrete base and then maybe a few inches of sand and then brick laid on top of that.
Right. Well, the truth is, Fran, that nature, and you've seen this. I mean, if you've been walking through downtown Philly or other big cities or something, you see these houses that have been abandoned maybe for only a year, and they've got trees growing out of them and stuff. So
yeah.
There's always seeds growing around. Soil, dirt, the debris from fall leaves, stuff that rubs off our shoes, fills these little cracks and weed seeds blow in. So it is almost impossible to have one of these kind of paver patio areas, bricks that aren't solid pieces and not have little bits of weeds growing in them. I have one of these poured concrete stamped patios that people think is continuous, but because of expansion and contraction, they have to leave some areas open. So I get surprise plants in there all the time. Sometimes I get really nice plants. I had one year, just by dumb luck, I had impatiens grow up through all my cracks. It looked like I was a genius.
Well, my concern was about getting rid of the weeds and the grass. I'd seen online about maybe pouring a water solution mixed with salt. I didn't know how you felt about that or if there's any other organic ways to get rid of the weeds, type of something that we could mix to put into the cracks.
You mean the same sodium chloride that's destroying our roadways and bridges and infrastructure? That's what you want to...
Well, I was almost thinking iodinized table salt. I didn't know.
Well, it's the same. Sodium chloride is sodium chloride.
It's still sodium chloride. I understand what you're saying, yeah.
For instance...
I was only going to mix a half a gallon or a gallon of that and try to, you know, pour it directly into the crack. Unless there other solutions.
That's one of the worst solutions I've ever heard. you really risk damaging your patio and changing the color. And I don't think you'd be able to get a high enough concentration to hurt the weeds. I mean, you know, you want to protect those surfaces out there. That's why you're not supposed to use rock salt to de-ice that patio in the winter, that you should be looking at the alternative de-icers, like potassium chloride or calcium chloride, which are much gentler on those kind of surfaces. So anyway, you got three choices for your weeds and grass. One is a flame weeder, which is one of my favorite tools. You'll go online, type in flame weeder, weed burner, and you'll see these are tools that use a small camp stove size bottle of propane to power a little flame out the end of a long wand. So you do all this standing up and you just go down the lanes in your brick and you dehydrate the weeds and they die. You don't have to stand there and toast them to a crispy doneness. Although if that's your idea of a good time, you go for it. And this is something that you would do, you know, in the middle of a hot and dry stretch when they'd already be a little stressed. The other is a tool that I believe, well, I mean, you could probably do this with a garden hose. If you have really good water pressure and you get one of these nozzles that really shoots out a laser beam,
Yeah. You
could use that to blast the weeds out. Although a catalog company called Lee Valley Tools, L-E-E Valley, they, for years, have been the only place that I've seen you can get something called the water-powered weeder. And this is a long spike with a trigger on it that you attach to your garden hose. And again, while standing up, you put the end of the spike into these little areas between your bricks, and it shoots this concentrated burst of water that knocks the weeds out. The problem is nature is always going to replace these with something. So the long-term solution is to actually clean them out and then go out and buy either something from a line of plants called steppables or any other low-growing plant that can take foot traffic. Some of these plants are aromatic herbs. Some of them are just little green plants, but they're very well behaved. They're slow growing. Believe it or not, these are plants that have been adapted and bred to deliberately grow in between pavers and bricks and give a lovely appearance. And again, some of them are even scented so that as you walk on the bricks, you'll get the scent of chamomile or mint or something like that. Creeping thyme is one of the big ones. But that's your choice, is a couple of times a year you can go out and burn them or shoot them out with water, or you can just cut to the chase and plant something there that's not going to interfere with the contraction and expansion that's necessary and is actually going to look nice. And because it'll be continuous, it'll be in all of the areas, it'll be obvious that this is deliberate, that you wanted this look.
Yeah, sure. All right, Mike, I appreciate your time. Thanks a lot for answering that question.
All right. Good luck, Fran. Thank you.
All right. Have a nice day.
You too, sir. 1-888-346-9499. Helen, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi.
Hello, Helen. How are you?
I'm pretty good. How about you?
I am doing just fine. Thank you. And where is Helen pretty good?
I'm in Long Valley, New Jersey.
All right. What can we do for Helen in Long Valley, New Jersey?
Well, the July issue of Nature had a summing up article that was covered on Science Friday, and they went into the examples of the seeds being, I guess they call it, dressed or soaked in the neonicotinoids.
Oh, yes, yes.
Mm-hmm. So yes. And they talked about it's in horticultural plants and it's in food crops. And so then all of a sudden I got really stressed about where to go and buy my plants. So that, because they say that systemically it gets into the seeds, into the foliage,
yes,
into everything.
Neonicotinoids are these pesticides that are real bee killers. Nobody argues with that. And they may be one of the biggest culprits behind colony collapse disorder, where hives of imported honeybees are dying off and the bees are not returning to the hive.
Right.
These pesticides have become endemic in the nursery trade. A lot of plants are sprayed with them as they're getting readied for sale, especially the cheaper plants down in the big box stores, although I wouldn't say that any place is immune from it. And yes, they are also one of the big issues that I've been hearing about is they're also used as seed treatments, so that right, when they are used as seed treatments, the neonicotinoid can get into the plant that's grown from that seed and still be there. Luckily, most of the use is as a foliar spray, so after a while it's washed away or it's destroyed by the sun and it goes away. But I mean, this is one reason to buy organic. Organic growers, organic seed producers, of course, aren't allowed to use these kind of pesticides and would never want to use these kind of pesticides. In addition, I heard the Science Friday. I love that show. And I believe one of the guests on Ira's show talked about one of the big chains creating a program of identifying plants that have been treated with these pesticides and ones that haven't. But you're absolutely right. This is now a case where people need to follow the paper trail on plants that they're buying for their garden. So one way to do this, if you have the talent or if you are willing to learn, is to start your own seeds. Buy organic seeds from an organic seed company and start them yourself.
Okay.
And then you'll know what you're getting.
But
otherwise, I think you are going to find a huge market in pesticide-free plants or plants that are certified as not having been treated with or grown from seed treated with neonicotinoids. And I expect you'll find that as early as this fall, which is the soonest you want to be putting in replacement plants. I think it's great that people have become aware of the problem on this level. But 90% of this game is not using pesticides in your own environment.
Right. Just very quickly, if you don't mind, the last question is along those lines. Do the really large seed sellers also soak the seeds in the neonics?
That's a good question. This is not something that has been regulated up to now. Treated seed has always been available, and treated seed, seed that's coated with Captan and Theram, which are devastatingly dangerous fungicides, these are wildly colored to try to tell people that they are coated with chemicals. There'll be neon pinks and reds and stuff. Okay. But everybody has a website. Everybody who has a seed company is very aware of social media right now. Mm-hmm. You have questions, you ask the company directly. I think you'll get answers. And I would expect from everyone I've ever met in this business, organic or conventional, you'll get honest answers. If they use these things, they'll just say they can't guarantee anything.
Okay, wonderful.
All right, well, thank you for caring.
Oh, thank you so much for all of that information. And I just listen to you every week because I learn new things.
All right, well, thank you very much, Helen, and thank you for your good work and your concern.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Steve, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you, Mike. Great show. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Steve. Where are you, man?
I'm in Cape May County. We're at the Cape May County Zoo. I live in Whitesboro, a little community just south of the courthouse.
What can we do for Steve in Cape May?
I have a small property in Whitesboro, and I'm trying to turn portions of it each year over to gardens.
Right.
And I'm going to do some raised beds eventually, but right at this point, I just want to find a way without using Roundup or chemicals or whatever to kill off the grass that's there over the winter. What can I put on it to kill that grass off? Everything they tell me at the Home Depots and the stuff like that, they tell me it's all high chemicals. So that's the water we drink. That's our well water.
Right, but it's also the only solution they have to sell, which is why where people go wrong. They'll go into a store that sells herbicides. They'll say they have a weed problem. And then they're shocked that people offer them chemicals. Well, that's all that they have. Now,
okay.
Normally I would say you need to get into your time machine and go back to the beginning of the summer, and you could have scalped your lawn and solarized it, which is a very specific method of covering an area that's been saturated with water with a specific type of clear plastic and holding it down at the sides, and the sun's rays cook any living plant material, disease, insect, pests out of the soil. It is it's a very effective tool for people who have serious soil disease problems, for instance.
Yeah.
But I don't think we got enough sun this summer. This summer has been so cool and so cloudy, even down the shore, solarization may not have taken hold. Now, the answer is there's very little you can do to, quote, kill a lawn over the winter, because I'm presuming you have a cool season lawn that stays green over the winter. Unfortunately, your lawn is at its strongest in the spring, the winter, and the fall. It's at its weakest now. Now, I'm also going to direct you to a resource. Go to our website. Go to You Bet Your Garden. And click on, at the top of the page, Garden Answers A to Z, and then there is an article under Lawns, Turning a Lawn into a Garden. It's a step-by-step,
really?
Yes, it's a step-by-step process. I've been doing this show for 16 years. We do a question of the week at the end of each show. There's like 700 of these things, you know. But what you want to do is you want to get a specialized knife, either one of these fabulous Japanese gardening knives that's long and sharp. Some people will go out and get, you remember the old curved linoleum knives?
Yeah.
Some people will get that. And some people who don't want to do the physical labor will go to one of these rental places and they will rent a sod cutter for the day.
Okay.
And that's a machine that mechanically removes the sections of grass in exactly the same way that sod farms do. So there are tools and machines that do this very efficiently. And the nice thing then is you start out with a clean slate. There's no herbicides. You haven't tilled the rhizomes into the soil where they're going to be coming back and biting you year after year. And now you also have these strips of grass that are perfectly acceptable to put somewhere else on your property or to give to a friend. But that's the answer. You actually mechanically remove the sod, and then you drop in your raised bed frames and fill those up with a mixture of compost and topsoil, and you're good to go.
Wow. Well, I hadn't thought of cutting the sod out. That makes a lot of sense, though. Okay.
All right, Steve.
All right, you keep up the good work. Thanks, Michael.
You go back to taunting the monkeys now.
Oh, yeah, the kids just showed up. It was perfect timing.
Yeah, same thing. All right, Steve, good luck.
See you. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Well, it's time for me to take a little break and reveal that we had a major voicemail snafu and unfortunately lost all the fascinating phone calls you made to our toll-free number from around July 22nd through the 29th. So if you called us with a comment, question, tip, trick, or whatever during that week, once again from around July 22nd through the 29th, please give us another shout. But don't go dialing 1-888-346-9499 just yet, because we'll be right back with more of your fabulous phone calls that we didn't lose and how to shape evergreen screening plants so as not to lose their precious screening. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
You Bet Your Garden is made possible in part by Summit Responsible Solutions. Summit Mosquito Dunks and Mosquito Bits contain BTI, which naturally controls mosquitoes without harming other living things, including people and pets. Online at summitresponsiblesolutions.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch right now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we'll get to the question of the week. A lot of people have itchy fingers about pruning plants that have grown too large for their space. Is this a good time to do it, and how can you prune those plants to keep their shape and their good look? It's not the way that you think you should be doing it or want to do it. So you'll want to listen to this important information coming up after a couple more of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Steve, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello, this is Steve from Connecticut. I have an iris and daffodil problem.
Okay, very good. What part of Connecticut, Steve?
Hartford.
Oh, sure. What can we do for your iris and daffodils?
I'm going to have to move them because of some construction going on.
Okay.
I hear that this is not necessarily a good time of the year. I want to know about moving them and putting them back in about a month or two.
Well, first of all, that would be too soon. The only reason this would not be a good time of year to take spring bulbs out of the ground is because you have now lost all the clues as to where they were. So you have to dig real carefully. I have found that digging up spring bulbs after all of the foliage has vanished and the stems are gone is like digging for potatoes. You're guaranteed to spear every third one. But you have a good idea of the basic area where they're planted.
I have markers where they grew, yes, all around the plot.
Oh, okay, but you don't have markers next to the individual bulbs.
Well, each area is about a foot and a half wide.
Okay.
So I've got marks around that whole circle.
So that's good. Just get a shovel and work the outsides of these small areas, and you'll get all the bulbs up out of the ground. And then you take the bulbs, you brush the dirt off them. One of the most important things here is don't wash them or anything like that.
Okay.
It's already been too wet this year. You don't want to introduce any more moisture. And then you just want to take the naked bulbs and hang them in onion bags in the coolest, driest spot of your house. For instance, if you have even a dehumidifier running somewhere in the room with them would be a great idea. Cool, dark, and dry. A lot of people who have rare bulbs or bulbs that don't return as reliably as daffodils, after all of the leaves have faded from green to brown, will dig up their bulbs in late spring and do just this, hang them in storage for the summer. Because in their native land, not Holland, where they were bred, but where they were originally poached from in the mountains of Turkey and Afghanistan and Russia, these bulbs go through the hottest, driest summer you can imagine. It never rains. And they've evolved to follow that pattern. So a lot of people destroy their bulbs because once the bulbs are gone and there's no visible record above ground, they will plant annual flowers over top of that spot. And that extra water and food that the people give those flowers often rots the bulbs below, which really want to be hot and dry for the entire summer. So it's a real mitzvah to actually get them out of the ground. Again, especially with a year as wet as we've had, letting them dry out a little bit will be great. And don't rush their replanting. For the best results, spring bulbs should go into the ground in your region, but you're still in a warm area, a little bit after Halloween. For most of the country, in between Halloween and Thanksgiving is the best time to put spring bulbs in the ground. You should never put them in the ground before Halloween unless you're in, like, the most frigid climate imaginable.
Okay, so I don't have to. I can wait much longer than after the construction is done.
I would.
I'm saying October.
Yes. If you were buying new ones to replace them, I would say to put them in October. Now, what shape are your irises in right now?
Mostly died back. The greens are still there because they will be year-round.
Those, it would be better to find another place on your property and do what's called healing them in. Get a spot of land, rough it up, take the irises out of the ground, and then heal them into this spot of land, preferably in the evening. Water them well, and as is always the case with iris, don't bury the entire rhizome. Just put half of it underground and keep it really well watered in the week or two after that transition period. And then when everything is stable again, you can put them back into their old home.
Nature will survive.
Yes, it will. All right, Steve, good luck, sir.
Hey, very good. Thank you.
1-888-346-9499. Jeff, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi.
Hello, Jeff. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing okay.
And where is Jeff okay?
In Ludlow, Pennsylvania.
Well, you got me there, Jeff, and you knew you would. Where the devil is Ludlow?
Right in the middle of the National Forest here.
Really? So still, help me out. Which National Forest?
The Allegheny National Forest.
Oh, okay. So you're in Western Pennsylvania.
Yes. Northwestern.
Okay. Very good. What can we do for Jeff on almost on the West Coast?
Well, I had a question about some wild black raspberries and red raspberries on my property.
Okay.
I was wondering, is there anything I could do or should be doing with them? You know, can I cut them down and maybe clean out all the underbrush that's down underneath there?
There are many types of wild berries. There are traditional black raspberries that are pretty much the same as in the supermarket that have escaped cultivation and now appear in the wild, mostly thanks to birds who eat the raspberries in people's plantings. And then these, quote, wild black raspberries will appear along fence lines and underneath trees where the birds roosted and then lightened their load before flying. There's also a wild berry that I am especially fond of that I am actually cultivating at home, whose common name is the wineberry. And this is an escaped ornamental. It has bright red canes, pretty big thorns, and the berries are bright red and incredibly juicy. They're the juiciest of these raspberry, blackberry-type berries. And you'll always know you have wineberries because what happens is the plant produces a pod, and then the pod opens up and the berry is inside. And then there's ones that I call the black cap raspberries. These generally come in very early in the season, grow low to the ground or along hillsides. And these are distinctive because when you pick them, the berry comes away from the part that holds it on the plant, whereby, you know, when you get a blackberry, that part is still inside the berry. The black cap raspberry comes away like a raspberry. You just get the fruit and the stem is left.
Yeah, that's what I have.
Okay, so the black cap raspberry is what you want to propagate.
Well, I just want to know, is there something that I should be doing that might help these grow a little bit better? Because this year they're not doing so well. We've had quite a bit of rain here.
So the answer is exactly what you're thinking. When you identify these plants, what you do is you go in and either with pruners or careful root pulling, you remove all of the wild grape and Virginia creeper and multiflora rose and all of the other truly invasive plants that tend to be growing in the same areas as these plants. Poison ivy, too. Has that been your experience? Those are the other plants that are clustering around them?
I've got all kinds of plants. They're right along the edge of the property into the woods.
That is exactly where these plants like to grow, right at the margins where things change.
And there's just so much undergrowth there, years of old branches, and everything's got prickers on it, you know. So the easy way would be maybe cut them down after they've, you know, produced their fruit.
Yeah, see, that's...
Clean it out there.
I would not recommend that. A lot of these berries are on unusual 2 and sometimes even 3 year cycles.
Well, these have been producing every year. I've probably got 6-8 pounds of black and red raspberries so far this year.
Right, but you're not tagging the canes to see exactly which ones are producing and which ones are resting and how old they are and how many years it took them to get to fruition. So
the best thing is to do, just let them do the wild thing and...
And remove every plant around them you can. Go in there with, like, leather gauntlets and pruners and cut off, like, the multiflora rose. Keep cutting the branches till you get back there. Pull the creeper out of the ground, especially when the soil is wet. Try not to disturb the black cap raspberries. But the more you can open up the area around them, the better they'll do and the easier they'll be able to expand. And, of course, you'll also prevent them from being overwhelmed. You know, a plant like wild grape will just eventually crush them.
Yeah, without cutting the actual plant down so I can get in there better, just kind of get in the best I can and leave the plant itself alone.
Exactly. I have never cut a healthy cane of any of my wild berries.
Uh-huh.
All right, Jeff?
Okay, thanks a lot, Mike.
All right, good luck, sir.
Yeah, thanks. Bye.
All right. As promised, it's time for the question of the week. Bringing a line of hemlocks down to size. Alexis Landis, producer of You Bet Your Garden, get us started with this week's question, please.
Sure, Mike. Will in Naugatuck, Connecticut writes, I'm wondering how I can bring a row of hemlocks that have grown to about 12 to 15 feet high and 6 to 8 feet wide down to about 8 feet high and in a couple of feet without damaging them.
Well, it depends on what kind of hemlocks these are. The basic type, the Eastern or Canadian hemlock, is a slow-growing evergreen that reaches 80 feet at maturity.
Yikes! And he's worried because they're 12 to 15 feet now?
Yeah, but he might have one of the dwarf varieties that stay relatively small. And in his classic The Pruning Book, our limb-lopping expert, Lee Reich, says that all hemlocks can be trained into hedge-like shapes, and unlike some evergreens, should regrow nicely from old wood, especially when they're still young. But Lee cautions that while they should respond well, quote, not all trees have read the pruning book, so our listeners should begin the process of bringing them slowly down in size next spring.
Not now?
No. Summer and fall are the worst times to remove healthy branches from any big tree or shrub. Pruning outside of the dormant period in winter stimulates new growth. Forcing that new growth in the summer can greatly stress a tree. Fall pruning is even worse, as it prevents the plants from going naturally dormant. And you want to be especially careful not to stress hemlocks, as it makes them much more vulnerable to attack by the woolly adelgid, a pest that's been decimating these trees.
So hands off until early spring, but then what?
Then I'd give serious thought to just trimming the sides back a bit every spring. Lee feels that hemlocks can take pruning better than most plants, but if these are standard trees, the trunks are still going to grow to their normal size, and keeping the tops really short could eventually look really weird. So we emailed Will back to ask what he knew about these trees, how long they've been in the ground, and if they've ever been pruned. His response was enlightening.
Will writes, these bushes or trees, I'm not sure what type they are, just that they're hemlocks, were planted before my parents bought the house 40 years ago. I've been trimming the sides for the past 25 years and the tops every 5 years or so. But there are brown areas near the bottom that expand each year regardless of how much green I take off.
Luckily, Will included a photo that showed a nice solid wall of green right next to a roadway. And, of course, growing right underneath power lines. Now, some browning at the bottom is inevitable when evergreens don't get enough sun down low. But the basic secret to keeping these kind of plants looking nice and full is to shape them slowly and gradually. Just because you suddenly realize you want to do something dramatic doesn't mean the plant is going to like it. Generally, it's just the reverse. Now, if they're 6 feet wide, he can easily prune a foot off of each side every spring without any kind of harm. Or, if the trunks are really thick, indicating that these are standard-sized trees, he might want to instead consider carefully removing a few, especially ones with a lot of browning down low, and let the sides of the remaining trees grow to fill in those spots. This would also let more light in and reduce the risk of future browning. But if he tries to reduce their height by almost half in one shot, they could die outright, and they'd certainly look ugly if they did survive. Luckily, his photo shows that they haven't grown too close to the power lines yet. So, with extreme caution because of those power lines, he should be able to achieve what's needed here.
But he'll have to have a safe way to get up there. A rickety ladder is always a bad idea, but a rickety ladder 15 feet in the air with an unbalanced man holding sharp cutting tools under power lines could end really badly.
Right, so we asked Will exactly how he plans to reach those tops safely, and his answer was very reassuring. For a long time, we just used a stepladder, he writes, which was not very safe. Now we use scaffolding, which is safer and helps the job go much faster.
Well, that's a relief.
So here's the plan. early next spring, when it's the right time to prune, and once he's up there safely, being extremely cautious not to let his head or tools get anywhere near those power lines, he should take his time, shaping the tops as he removes height. Reduce them by about 2 feet a season, and he'll eventually get them down to a manageable 10 feet or so without any damage.
But he wants them to be 8 feet.
You know, the trees don't care what he wants. In fact, they'd much rather just be left alone. So spread the task out over a few more seasons than you'd like. Let them end up being a little bit taller than you'd like, and I'll bet you the result will be something that you'll really like. Well, that sure was an interesting look at how and when to trim evergreens now, wasn't it? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read it over in detail, with links to lots of previous articles warning about the dangers of late-season pruning, just click the link for the question of the week at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Gardens Alive supports the You Bet Your Garden question of the week. Yikes, my producer is threatening to hack my hemlocks if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499 or send us your email, you're tired, you're poor, you're wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org. Please remember,
tell us where you live, tell us your location, please, please, oh, it's so important.
And visit our website, youbetyourgarden.org. where you'll find answers to all your garden questions, audio of this show, past shows, and our podcast. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week is Fred Snyder. Rich Banowitz and Sarah Kazar, You Bet Your Garden's webpage wonders. Our social media director is Amanda McGrath. Check out her fine work at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Our editor is Al, what happened to my phone calls, Banks. Alexis Landis produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia and says, I didn't lose no phone calls. Our production assistant, Tricia Whiting, who has suspiciously changed her name to Trixie, says, phone calls? What phone calls? Our hired hand, Matt Hudecki, says, yeah, me too. I don't know nothing about no phone calls. And hey, where did that briefcase come from? I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and I'll be sitting right by the phone until I can see you again next week. Yo, Al, let's dust this baby for prints. Round up the usual suspects. In regions where winter was harsh, there is a stunning lack of hydrangeas in bloom. I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, we'll reveal why this happened and how to get your shrubs back into gear for next season. Plus your fabulous phone calls.